supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Cleaning up vacant lots in Philadelphia neighborhoods can lead to a drop in crime and a boost in personal well-being. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Those are findings of a new study of more than 500 lots that received a blight cleanup. Participating in the study and joining me now is Dr. Eugenia South, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and the Presbyterian Medical Center of Philadelphia. Dr. South, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
These were blighted lots that were subsequently cleaned up. What did that entail?
Yeah, so as you know, and as people in Philadelphia know, there are over 40,000 vacant lots and abandoned buildings in the city, and these rundown and dilapidated spaces are a threat to our health and safety. So we studied a clean and green intervention that entailed removing trash, planting new grass and trees, and putting a low wooden fence around the perimeter, as well as a cleaning-only intervention.
Is there any dispute that that threat manifests itself in symptoms including stress, cardiovascular, and mental health symptomology as well?
Yeah, there is pretty good evidence that these spaces are associated with those health threats. And work that we've done in the past interviewing Philadelphia residents points to those associations as well.
So how did you measure before and after in terms of crime reduction and well-being?
So we interviewed almost 450 people that lived around the lots that were in the study, and we found that people reported feeling safer, 58% feeling safer. People reported going outside to socialize and relax 75% more, which is really amazing. We also then looked at police-reported crime that was taking place in the areas of the study before and after the intervention and found up to a 29% reduction in gun violence around lots that received the intervention.
Were the most profound results in the most profoundly blighted sections of the city?
That's exactly right. Our most pronounced results took place in the poorest neighborhoods of the city, which makes this a really attractive and exciting intervention and tool to improve the quality of life disparities that we see in historically under-resourced neighborhoods.
Attractive and exciting, but there must be a cost attached. And what is the cost in this case to beautify the lots that you tested?
So the cost is about $5 per square meter, and then it takes about 50 cents per square meter thereafter to maintain it. Overall, it's a relatively low cost and easily reproducible intervention.
Have any municipal authorities taken note of your studies and the results?
Yeah, so one of the outcomes of this work has been other cities like New Orleans, Flint, Michigan, New Haven, Connecticut, coming to Philadelphia and learning about this intervention, which I should mention is performed by the Pennsylvania Horticulture Society. So other cities have come here to learn and are bringing this back to their cities, and we're studying that as well.
As this is a particular focus of yours, how next will you move in this direction?
So we are now studying a intervention to abandoned houses. So similarly, to restore abandoned houses and not just vacant and abandoned land. We're also interested in seeing if there's a way to interact with people more directly to get them to spend more time in green space in their neighborhoods and communities.
Dr. South, draw on your experience as an emergency room doctor and the correlation between this effort and reduced violence and specifically gun violence.
So in my work as an emergency physician, I see firsthand the destruction that gun violence plays in people's lives, for individuals, for families, and for whole neighborhoods. So if there is an intervention that cities can perform in neighborhoods to prevent people from becoming my patients in the first place, that is really exciting information and news and science.
Dr. South, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Eugenia South, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and the Presbyterian Medical Center of Philadelphia. Once again, gun violence is at the forefront of national conversation following last week's mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida. For many Philadelphians, gun violence is a daily fear and concern. Helen Ubinas, columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, wonders if the outrage spurred by the Parkland shooting will make an impact on, quote, everyday shootings. She offers this commentary.
I stood on the corner of 2nd and Cambria last week with the family of a woman who'd been shot and killed nearby. They came to memorialize Christina Tosado's life, a daughter, a mother, a woman full of life before she was gunned down outside a bar a year ago on February 19, 2017. Two bullets, fired from a car, hit her. She died a few hours later, leaving behind three children who had already lost their father to an illness. I watched Tosado's mother, Sylvia Barreto, set bouquets of flowers on the concrete. I watched family and friends try to keep the flickering candles going. I watched her oldest daughter, Ashley, cry into balled-up fists. It was hard to look away. Her tears and anger were familiar. We've spent more than a week now transfixed on the students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Young Floridians who were devastated by a shooter who walked into their school on Valentine's Day with an AR-15 and killed 17 of their classmates and teachers. We watched their tears turn to anger and then uncensored and uncompromised determination to do what adults around them won't. For proof of that, all you have to do is watch Senator Marco Rubio tap dance when one of the survivors asked him at a CNN town hall to prioritize bloodshed over blood money and reject NRA donations. Or watch President Trump and the NRA double down on the insanity by suggesting teachers who can't get enough toilet paper for their students can now suddenly get guns. It is the students' righteous fury that continues to rise above, to promise a new conversation on guns. I thought about that as I watched Ashley, whose tears mixed with anger at how guns have ruined her life. She's just 22, and now she is responsible for her two siblings. I watched a grandmother who worries she will never get justice she's waited years for. 20 years before her daughter was killed, her 17-year-old son was shot and killed during a robbery. He had $5 in his pocket. I wondered if the youthful fury from the Parkland students that has moved and inspired so many of us will trickle down to cities and the everyday shootings that never get enough attention. The crowd on the Philly corner was small, but I noticed that there were almost as many young people as adults. I wondered if they could help spark a long overdue reckoning on gun violence in Philadelphia. At the memorial, I turned to two grieving women and shared an idea. What if kids in Philly took to the streets and called BS on the no snitching culture? A big reason why more than half of the city's murders go unsolved. What if our kids said, as loudly and equivocally as the Florida teens, never again? And what if this time we listened? A few days after the sidewalk gathering, I reached out to Ashley to ask about some of the things that were going through my mind while standing on the corner with her. How a mass uprising of young people in this city right now could maybe turn the tide. She was polite and thoughtful and not nearly as hopeful as a reporter with the luxury of entertaining ideas. She was living in the very real aftermath of gun violence. I get it. I'm just not ready to let this idea or hope go.
In western Pennsylvania, the Marcellus Shale industry is moving into some of Pittsburgh's biggest suburbs, and as it does so, it's rekindling a debate about the risks and rewards of drilling. Reporting for State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier found that suburbanites and elected officials now have to decide what to do about fracking in their backyards.
Plum Borough is one of Allegheny County's more expansive suburbs. At 29 square miles, it's bigger than Manhattan. It's a landscape of rolling hills and steep hollows just 7 miles east of the Pittsburgh city line. Michael Thomas, who grew up in the city, discovered that landscape when he came to work in Plum as borough manager 13 years ago.
When I first came here and saw the horses and the cows and the sheep, I mean, just something you don't expect in a Pittsburgh suburb. It just isn't.
Over the years, houses have started to fill in those open spaces. For decades, Plum has had small, conventional gas wells dotting its landscape. Thomas didn't think that the bigger, more intensive operations of the Marcellus shale industry would come to this community of 27,000. Then one day last summer, it did.
Actually, to be honest with you, I was on vacation, and I got an email from a council member that said, "Are you going to the meeting tonight?" And my response was, "What meeting?"
It was a public hearing for an underground injection well for fracking waste held by the EPA. 200 residents came out to oppose it. Pretty soon, the borough got word that another company wanted to build shale gas wells. This came as a surprise to Thomas, who thought that the drilling industry would stay in the more rural parts of the state.
We were not anticipating a lot of requests or a lot of permit requests for wellheads in Plum because property down here is, all things being equal, properties, you know, you can get a lot more property up in Elk County a lot cheaper than you can in Allegheny.
But in the last year or so, interest in gas drilling in Pittsburgh suburbs has increased. Wells have been permitted or are being planned for as close as 4 miles from the city line. Fracking has brought jobs to Pennsylvania and riches for some landowners, but also controversy. Opponents say the process burdens local communities with truck traffic, emissions from gas wells, and the potential to harm groundwater. But that debate has largely skipped over Pittsburgh and its biggest suburbs until now. Doug Shields is a former city council member from Pittsburgh who now works for the environmental group Food and Water Watch. He says all you need to do is look at a map of gas wells in western Pennsylvania to understand why the gas industry is interested in the suburbs of Pittsburgh.
You'll immediately take note that Allegheny County looks like an island in a sea of gas wells on their maps.
But drilling companies have so far stuck to the surrounding more rural counties. Allegheny County has just over 100 Marcellus gas wells, while Washington County, to the south, has 1,700.
And it is our premise that it is only a matter of time before there are going to be significant encroachments into these high-density populations.
Allegheny County has 130 municipalities, some as small as 50 acres. Each can regulate fracking through zoning, so deciding where companies can drill is now becoming a big open question in Pittsburgh suburbs. Through his job with Food and Water Watch, Shields offers to help communities update local laws to include gas drilling restrictions. He said only about a third have zoning ordinances that have up-to-date oil and gas designations. But he said that's beginning to change.
And these communities kind of woke up quickly and began to understand they need to protect themselves.
Oakmont, next to Plum, has enacted stricter limits on gas wells. Monroeville also adopted a more restrictive zoning policy, but the municipality is now rethinking that decision. A few months ago, Plum decided to allow drilling in about a third of the municipality. Thomas, the Plum manager, said that was a compromise. Some residents who owned gas rights wanted to expand the map to allow drilling in more densely populated areas. Others wanted to restrict it to just a handful of industrial zones.
My rule is always to try to strike the balance. You know, if we don't let people make money, you know, we don't have a healthy economy here in the community. If you have everything running rampant, you lose residents because nobody wants to be. So it's always about striking that balance.
He said public opinion in the borough was mixed, but that most he'd talked to were friendly to the idea of drilling.
I'd say it's probably about 60-40. I'd say, you know, 6 out of every 10 people that I talk to are, you know, let's drill, let's drill, let's drill. And about 4 of every 10 are, you know, we got to think about this. We got to stop this.
On top of that, he worried that the company drilling the well, Huntley and Huntley, would sue the borough if it made the ordinance too restrictive.
Our thought process was essentially that there was a pretty good risk of losing that battle.
Huntley and Huntley did not agree to an interview. But in an email, a company spokesman said that problems predicted by environmentalists at the company's other sites never materialized, and that the company was concentrating its Marcellus drilling on the more sparsely populated parts of Plum. The company's first Marcellus gas well in Plum is now taking shape. Dave Vento takes me to see it.
You know, there's the site. See, that's the Midas well pad.
Vento is a foreman with the Pennsylvania Turnpike and sat on Plum's borough council for 12 years. At the side of a busy road, backhoes move dirt around a construction site.
This was woods. It was all woods. I used to actually ride dirt bikes and through this area. You know, this was a fruit stand here.
It looks like it could be any kind of development, but in a few months, a drilling rig will be erected there. At a nearby Panera, Vento says he doesn't want large-scale fracking to come to Plum. He's worried about truck traffic, potential damage to water wells, and how industrial activity would mix with this bedroom community. He says he understands some of his neighbors would benefit from lucrative royalty payments, but doesn't think it's worth it.
Well, I would say absolutely it's good for them, but at what cost to the rest of the community? You live in a community. You don't live by yourself. You know, this isn't the Wild Wild West. We live in a community. We're surrounded by humans. You know, it's just what you consider your right and what you don't consider your right.
As drilling moves into the suburbs here, it's a question more and more people will be asking. Reed Fraser, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
For the next 2 years, the Barnes Foundation is turning over its former ticket office on the Ben Franklin Parkway to Philadelphia's Mural Arts Program. The mostly glass box visible from the sidewalk will be filled with public art projects, including work by artists who were recently released from prison. Details from WHYY's Peter Crimmins.
The Barnes Foundation site on the parkway used to be a juvenile detention center. It's where Russell Craig first entered the criminal justice system, something he would be in and out of for the better part of the next 12 years.
I think I'm more than just me being here. Just that whole era of my life for many years was just a whole different thing than this. So it's just like, it's really overwhelming.
Both Craig and this piece of real estate have changed dramatically in the last decade. He is now a rising artist, often working in the vein of criminal justice reform. And that juvenile detention center was torn down to make way for one of the world's preeminent collections of modern and impressionist art. The Barnes Foundation has given its former visitor center, a small detached building on 20th Street, over to Mural Arts Philadelphia for the next 2 years. With a studio literally at the door of a major art collection, director of Mural Arts, Jane Golden, is thinking about education, artist residencies, restorative justice, and public engagement.
I mean, I think the sky's the limit because it's so interesting to have a space in close proximity to an arts institution like the Barnes. It's like it opens up a sea of possibilities.
Shelley Bernstein with the Barnes says giving the building over to public art projects is a win-win for everybody.
Our strategic plan at the Barnes right now is a lot about how we become more equitable within the city, right? How we become more of an access point. And I started to look around, and Mural Arts was clearly doing impactful work everywhere.
This Sunday, the public is invited to drop into the Barnes Studio to visit the formerly incarcerated artists as they work on an installation intended to be shown in area churches. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
It's been almost 140 years since Henrik Ibsen wrote A Doll's House, his forward-looking play and one of the theater's most compelling emblems for feminism. In a version by Simon Stevens, now at Arden Theater Company, the play still traces a woman's unsure path to liberation, though WHYY's Howard Shapiro says it's less compelling. He offers this review.
The great Norwegian playwright Henrik Ibsen wrote in Danish, the standard language of Norway in the 19th century. The Arden is using a recent version of A Doll's House by Simon Stevens, a Tony Award winner, for his adaptation of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime a few years back. The language Stevens uses is more modern than other translations, but the overall result is a weaker play. The husband of the house still patronizes his wife Nora with names like Skylark and Bluebird and Little Hamster. Yuck. And Nora still reacts with a smile, even though she's not childlike at all. She's borrowed money illegally and secretly a while back in order to provide a treatment for her then ailing husband, and she's still paying it off. This new version softens some dialogue that would help us understand the characters' motives, and that would make them feel more genuine. Terence J. Nolan's pleasantly swift staging with an indisputably talented cast works for the first half, but the play slows down considerably after intermission, when its steam should be gaining constant pressure. That's especially true just after this key scene, when Torval finds out about Nora's secret loan and explodes, and Nora insists on explaining her feelings about their marriage to her husband. They're played by Catherine Powell and Cody Nickel.
When I was a little girl, My father told me all his opinions, and so I inherited those opinions. And if I ever had any other opinions, then I hid them from him because they would have made him furious. He called me his doll. He played with me like I used to play with my dolls. Then I was taken to your house.
What kind of expression is that?
An accurate one.
Is it okay to do something you know is wrong in order to achieve something you believe is right? That big question in A Doll's House overrides any of this version's weaknesses and makes the play always relevant. Its feminist side comes famously toward the end, when Nora makes an unorthodox decision that liberates her and that involves questions of right and wrong as well. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
A Doll's House is in performance at the Arden Theater Company through March 4th. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.